Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, home of the modern whitetail hunter. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon. And this week on the show, I'm joined by Mark Haslam, the 2019 NDA Deer Manager of the Year, to discuss his lessons learned and best practices for improving whitetail habitat in the Southeast. All right, welcome back to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by First Light. Today in the show, we are continuing to talk habitat. We're going to be discussing, in particular, southern whitetail habitat. Now, I think a lot we're going to discuss will be replicable and relevant to you if you're in the Midwest or the Northeast, but I'm giving a little extra love to those of you down in the South. My guest today, Mark Haslam, hails from the Southeast. He's got a family farm down in South Carolina, and today we're going to be talking about the story of this place. We're going to be talking about what he's learned in the many years since he began managing. You know, last week we talked to some guys who have just recently gotten into the land management game. They've been into it just a few years. Today, with Mark, he's been doing this for 15-plus years, diving really deep into this and learning really the ups, downs, ins, and outs of what it takes to improve a piece of ground, manage a deer herd, and enjoy it. So we're going to discuss everything from timber management, hinge cutting, clear cutting, planting pines, doing dormant season burns, the pros and cons of food plots, getting natural food plots going, sun hemp, conservation easements, who knows what else? A whole bunch else is hit on in this one. Mark's a great guy. He's actually going to be contributing a little bit more to Wired to Hunt for us in the future. So look for articles from him coming down the line over on the Wired to Hunt website as well. And he's got a lot to offer. So that is my pitch for today's episode. Hope you're going to stick around. Hope you enjoy this one. If you've been out there working the ground already, I think this will be just what you need to inspire the next weekend or the next weeknight of work. So thanks for being here. Let's get to my chat with Mark Haslam. All right, here with me now on the show, I've got Mark Haslam. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
Tell you what, you've got a good name. Right off the bat, I got to tell you that. It's always good to have a fellow Mark on the show. That hasn't happened too often, so I like that. But in all seriousness, it's great to have you on here. I've been, you know, kind of following some of your work from afar over the years, Mark. I've seen how you've been doing a really great job of showcasing and sharing your family farm with other people and mentoring new hunters. I saw when you won the Deer Manager of the Year award and thought to myself, man, he seems like someone who's very deserving of that. And I started reading more of your work and kind of just seeing what you're doing on social media just recently. I know we've gotten you starting to do a little bit of writing for us at Wired to Hunt. So in short, this is a conversation I'm really glad we're having. And I know you've got a lot to offer. So thanks for making time to be here. What was that experience like, Mark? Before we get into the real meat and potatoes of what I want to talk about, What was that experience like when you found out that you won the Deer Manager of the Year award from the National Deer Association? Was that something that you thought, oh yeah, this is coming my way someday, or were you surprised by that?
Absolutely shocked. I both my father and I did not see that coming. We put on at the time, a QDMA mentored hunt, that previous fall. And we invited Joe Hamilton, the founder of QDMA, now the National Deer Association. And Joe Hamilton is just an absolute national treasure. And he saw what we were doing. He resides about an hour and a half from our farm, and he saw what we were doing and, in the longevity that we were doing things at the farm. And, I had no clue. Dad and I were planning to attend Whitetail Weekend, later that, I guess it'd be March of 2020. And, when Joe started to read our, background before giving the award, that was very surreal. Absolutely was, because for me, I was a lifelong QDMA member, going back to the mid late 90s, back when we were in a hunting club. And so that was, very much, surreal and just shock for me.
Yeah. I can't imagine. And I guess that's a great place for us to start, because I think that this award you were given, I think, is representative of the work and the transformation that you guys put into place over the last 15 years or so on this farm that Joe visited with you down in South Carolina. From what I understand, your family, you guys acquired this place back in 2006, right? Can you That's fill correct. Me in on, you know, what's the family farm look like? What was this place like when you stepped foot on it so many years ago?
Originally, it was a raw piece of land. And when I say a raw piece of land, it was being maintained by a forester. It was in a family that originally owned a much larger piece, had been passed down through many generations. I think there was about 12 or 14 different owners that had to sign off on the sale. They actually had to track some people down. But it was one of those classic, you know, examples of, you know, a piece of property that was in a family for a long period of time, and none of the current owners had any, you know, ties to the land. They had a forester that was maintaining the forestry work and sending checks, you know, when they cut timber, and they leased the hunting rights out to a hunting club. So it was a very raw piece of land, but that's what drew us to it. And it was a good location, being somewhat centered between, two very large, you know, two of the closer, cities. So when you start to distance yourself from larger cities, you start to see the price per acre and the price of dirt dip down before it rises back up going to the next city.
So what about the terrain and habitat? I mean, I know nothing about South Carolina. So can you paint a picture for me what this ground looks like? What kind of plant life? Is this swampy wet stuff? Is this high ground? Is this hilly? Is this big timber? What was the breakdown there?
This would be considered the Midlands of South Carolina, the lower western part of the state. It's right on the, or just north of the low country area, which is mostly coastal plains. The coastal plains would run all the way from South Carolina all the way to Alabama, Mississippi. And it's exactly what it sounds like, very flat. I mean, I live in Savannah, and we are at sea level right now. So it's very flat, but we're right on the north side of that. And just when the state starts to get a little bit of terrain features, slight rolling hills, elevation drops, I would call them hills living at sea level. Some of our elevation drops would be 10 to 15, 20 feet. We do have a couple Carolina bays, which is a geological term. And the idea, the theory, which I think has been some substantial evidence, but there were some meteors way back when that hit the ground and created some oval shape depressions. And so those are called Carolina bays. We do have several spring-fed creeks, some swamps, some bottomland, but it's primarily a pine farm. And that's what you see a lot in this region of the Southeast. And the highest and best use would be growing pine trees with a good amount of acreage for cultivated fields, farmland.
Okay. So what about the wildlife population, the deer population? When you guys showed up there in 2006, what did that like? Was this place flourishing already, or were you starting with a little bit of a fixer-upper?
It was certainly a fixer-upper. It was a great piece of property. It had been in a hunting club, I think, for several decades. And with that, we did not know exactly what their goals were and what they were harvesting. Based on some of the information that we received and actually talking to them, and they still have a club in existence. I think they weren't practicing, you know, all the fundamentals of the QDM model, quality deer management model, which is perfectly fine. I mean, that's legal to do, but I don't know if they were letting young bucks walk. So we didn't know what we had as far as bucks. Definitely had some deer on the property, very little turkeys, and at the time, no quail, no bobwhite quail. But, you know, we just did not know what we had as far as the deer population.
Okay. And then I guess what were you hoping for? Like when you guys stepped foot, like what were you hoping? What am I trying to say here? What were your hopes and dreams and goals for this place? Because it sounds like you were pretty serious into deer hunting already, having been a QDMA member for a long time. So when you stepped foot on that farm in 2006, was it, okay, we're going to go gung-ho doing everything we've learned about from reading the magazine and studying these things over the years? Or what was the plan when you guys began this journey?
The plan was to take it very, very slow. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. The plan was to take it slow, but we ended up over time just taking it very, very slow. Originally, just stepping foot the property, my short-term plan was to put some tree stands on some of the ag fields that had peanuts or corn, and just hunt and wait until I saw, you know, a 160 inch come out. I just had, you know, we just didn't know what we had. We knew that the deer population would be a lot different than what we were used to hunting on the coastal plain, the coastal South Carolina, coastal Georgia. But we didn't know what we had. The plan was just to take it slow, observe, and just right off the bat, keep doing what we were doing in our hunting club for many, many years, and that is keeping good hunter observations. And that's still what we do to this day. Keeping a hunting observation log, everything you see on the stand, and then, of course, a harvest log data. But I did shoot my first buck on the property, I think, to the third or fourth season. And that was just a process of letting – I let a lot of bucks walk that, in hindsight, I probably would have – knowing what I know now, I would have shot. But we just – we weren't really sure what we had, and what we were, and when I say that, we were basing that off some friends of ours that had similar type properties, but had been managing it and practicing the QDM model for a lot longer. So we just didn't know if that was something that where we could kind of slip right into and tweak a couple things, or it ended up being a 5 to 6 year plan to kind of get it to where we were consistently seeing mature bucks on the stand and on trail camera, and then being able to maintain and observe and understand our deer herd.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said about one of the things you carried over from your hunting club days, which was really good hunting or hunter observations and harvest observations and records. Can you walk me through, you know, what that actually means? How were you doing that? What kind of things were you taking note of? You know, was this in an actual journal that you carry with you everywhere? Like, how do you actually do this well?
Absolutely. I'd love to. You know, this is just a classic QDM fundamental practice. And that is, you know, your hunter observation on the stand and your harvest data log. So, you know, this goes back to our hunting club, and the earliest I can remember being there is in kindergarten, just wearing one of those, insulated old school camo jumpsuits where yes. I was like a Michelin man and I couldn't even like move my arms.
The good old days.
That's right. But what we, you know, nowadays there are apps, for hunt clubs where you can sign in and sign out on your phone, but we had a clubhouse and there was a little bulletin board, right there, the clubhouse where you sign in and you put a magnet on the aerial map of where you're going to hunt, you put your name in and then you sign out. We sign out, you put what you saw, or if you shot something, at the skinning shed, you would take the live weight. We weren't necessarily doing all these things at the hunt club, but we had tweaked it to where, at our farm, we were, you know, at the end of the hunt, writing everything we saw as far as whitetails, I'm breaking it down within fawns. You know, if it's a skilled hunter or a hunter that we feel like knows what they're looking at, we will put button bucks or doe fawn. If not, just simply fawns, does, and then antlered bucks. And depending on, you know, if someone's confident, you know, what particular buck they saw, 6 point, 8 point, maybe it's a 2-year-old 8 point, maybe it's a 4-year-old 8 point. And then the harvest log. And this is harvest log. I mean, both are an imperative, but the harvest log is very, very key. And everyone doesn't have a skinning shed on their property. Everyone doesn't have a scale on the property. So some people take their deer to a processor. And back in the day, before we had a skinning shed, you know, I would wait at the processor until he or she weighed my deer so I could get the weight and the jawbone because I did not want to leave and potentially them not weigh it. But when you have that data, here are some of the highlight bullet points that you can get from it. From the hunter observation, you'll see at the end of the season, and this is what we do right now, you know, after the season rolling into the following fall, is you'll get a breakdown as far as how many does you saw on average per hunt, how many bucks you saw on average per hunt, your buck to doe ratio. I mean, that's, you know, we use an online service. It's very inexpensive and you upload all this information.
What's it called?
The website that we use is called deermanage.com.
Okay.
And you just upload all the data and it breaks down. It gives you the estimated bucks to doe ratio, which is that alone is one of the top points to focus on. And one sidebar of that and why it's important was because after about 10 or so years, when we really had the farm fine tuned, we were starting to get a lot of bucks on camera. We were growing bucks and we were seeing bucks in person, and we went through that phase where we were hunting more bucks than we were regulating the does. And our doe numbers, our doe harvest dipped down. And what we saw was our buck to doe ratio shot up way out of whack. And so for the past number of years, we've been just hammering the does trying to catch up. That's why that's important. You'll also get the fawn recruitment. You know, what's your fawn recruitment like? And that's why taking those jotting down, you know, fawns, that's important. You know, people are concerned about coyotes and, you know, trapping, or do you have adequate, fawn bedding? And then also, for instance, if you're seeing one antlered buck for every 10 does, that could be a problem. If you're seeing one antlered buck for every 15 plus or 15 to 20 does, that's a major problem. You've got way too many does. And sure, you might still kill some large bucks, but your buck to doe ratio is way out of whack. And there's, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably understand what that can cause as far as the rut and then fawns dropping. And then with the harvest log, you're extracting the jawbone, which is, you know, besides sending off the jawbone to get tested, the teeth, I mean, that's one of the top ways of actually aging a deer, taking the live weight. And then, for instance, like if it's a doe, was it lactating? Was it lactating in September? Well, that's common. That's good. Was it lactating in November? That's a lot longer. If a doe is lactating in November, December, that can tell you some things about your rut and about the buck to doe ratio. And that's just an excellent way to keep track of your deer population. Are the weights trending up or trending down? just there's a lot of different things you can, and then you can look at, there's all kinds of data. Francis Moon, so this website will factor the moon in, and it'll show you how many deer on average you're seeing with every moon phase, temperature, wind, everything like that.
Has that level of analysis kind of highlighted any kind of correlation with the moon or anything? I mean, this is just like a pet project favorite of mine, always talking about these things and looking into that. And, you know, one of the big pieces of pushback along the lines for most of that is that there's not a lot of peer-reviewed research that can point to a connection between any of those factors like the moon, temperature, barometric pressure, and deer movement. But so many hunters feel like there is. Have you seen anything line up with that with your own data?
I can send you the data, and I can, and I'd be willing to post on social media, but there is absolutely no correlation whatsoever between hunter observation and the moon phase, deer movement. There's just not. There is no change whatsoever with the moon phase. I was smiling when you brought this up. I personally just get a chuckle out of the moon. I feel like a lot of people just they tend to hunt when they feel like they have, you know, some people can pick and choose when they hunt based on whatever condition they like. And some people, maybe like you and me, that have a couple kids and a job and a wife and a household, and we hunt when we can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typically without even looking at data, the best times to hunt and the best places to hunt and when to hunt are going to be early or places where there's been very little pressure.
Yeah.
And yeah, so in my opinion.
Makes a lot of sense. I want to rewind the tape a little bit to where a lot of this began, because it seems like, you know, taking the level of detail that you're looking at things, the records you're keeping, that must have really helped inform so many of the decisions you guys made along the way, since you had real data to look at. But I'm sure that, especially in those early years, you had some false starts. On my Back 40 project, for example, a few years ago, I had plenty of false starts when I was getting into this whole world of kind of taking that next step in land management. I'm kind of curious what those looked like for you guys. Can you, if you thought about those first, 5 years maybe, does anything stand out as some of the biggest mistakes you made in those early years, or something that you just really got wrong? Does anything come to mind?
Well, how much time do we have? Yes, to answer your question, yes, there's definitely a lot. Some items that come to mind would be planting trees. We bought some fruit trees early on, and that weren't really even suitable for that area, South Carolina. We planted some oak trees, a lot of sawtooth oaks, which a lot of people, you know, now there's a little bit of pushback as far as planting those. I still like them, but we planted some of these trees far too close together, did not space them out far enough. Food plots. We weren't doing soil samples originally. And before we really opened up some of the property, we were squeezing food plots in wherever we could, because the previous hunters were not planting food plots. There was a farmer, there was a couple hundred acres of farmland, so you had that to hunt over or to hunt around. But we were squeezing food plots a lot in, like, on fire breaks or roads that we didn't use as much, or little fallow areas. And a lot of those areas did not get sunlight, very little sunlight. And that was a bust. Because you buy seed and you plant it. We weren't spraying for weed control. We weren't doing the soil samples, and then you're not really monitoring really what comes up. Is it weeds popping up, or is it a plant that you plant with a seed? And then stand location. You know, some of the stand locations we had early on were around roads. And that was just a factor of not really having the time yet to open the property up. But sometimes hunters, and this is what we were guilty of, we put deer stands where we thought the best places would be based on just our preferences, but we weren't necessarily basing it on where the deer are. How do the deer use our property? Where are they coming from? Where are they bedding? Where are they going? You know, not basing the stand location, the stand setup based on the deer movement. We're basing it on, you know, what worked best for us.
I think that's something that a lot of folks, myself included, are guilty of.
Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey. Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th. The Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25, The Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27, The Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, The Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, The Egyptian in Boise. May 1, The Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, The Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
So plenty of mistakes along the way. What was, if there's anything that kind of fits this, what was the impetus for positive change? Like, if was there anything you can point back to where things all of a sudden started to click? Did you change something with your food plots and all of a sudden, oh, now things are coming together? Or did you open up these new roads or new access points to allow you to hunt deeper into the property, and then all of a sudden that was what changed things? Was there any big epiphany or light switch moment, you know, where you kind of hit a fork in the road and all of a sudden your results started changing? Was there any kind of line in the sand where all of a sudden everything was different after that?
I would say, to answer that question, was probably the first logging contract we had the farm. And the first time we had some a timber crew in the farm to cut pine trees. The first cut was just a thin. It was actually a combination to thin some trees. And what that did was open up some of the canopy, gets more sunlight in. And then they also created some loading decks. So when you cut pine trees, there's a site usually that they clear cut, like a smallish site where they clear cut first, and then that's where they're loading the timber. That's where the machines are dragging the timber, and then they're loading it on the semi trucks. So when that's done, what we did on those old loading decks was to clean it up. We stumped it and then cleaned up all the leftover debris, burned the leftover debris, and then converted those into food plots. That was a huge change for us because that gave us an actual smallish field that may be like a quarter acre or half acre to plant a food plot. And then with the thinning, that allowed expose some sunlight, open the canopy up to get more sunlight on the ground, disturb the ground and get some natural growth. And then combined with that, they also widened the road for us. They cut some trees along the roads, widened the roads better. We did some road work. When you widen the roads, especially in the south, it helps dry the roads out. It helps to, dry them out. The sun hits it. It's not as muddy. That was probably just the start of being involved with the forestry work. And then that next cut, which wasn't that far after, we ended up clear cutting two sections that were very close to each other that had some ice damage. And it was one of those where we could either just let that timber stand be, and it's not going to produce as well as it should because there's some ice damage, or clear cut it. And at the time, we knew the best option for our income to maximize income on that pine stand. But I was not looking forward to a clear cut at all. And after they clear cut those sections right in the middle of the property, they weren't all that big. They're probably two sections that maybe equaled about 50 or 60 acres. It just looked like a wasteland. I mean, it looked like a bomb went off. But over the next couple of years, being able to hunt around that clear cut after it was planted with pine trees, hunting around it, and then when it thickened up to become just an incredible whitetail bedding thicket, which was what pine thickets do when you replant, that's when things really started to click with me as far as how we can manipulate the landscape to not only do the forestry work, but then also to better the wildlife habitat and to better the huntability of the farm. Hmm.
So I read somewhere that you believe that timber management is now the single greatest tool you have in your goals towards growing mature bucks and maintaining a healthy deer herd. Can you expand a little bit on what you just told me there about why you find this to be such a powerful tool?
Yeah. So, the South is very heavy with tree farms, pine farms. And it's exactly what it said. I mean, exactly what I said. I mean, it's you have an inventory of trees that's your crop, and that's what you're growing for, 25, 30 plus years, depending on the species. And, a lot of people, some people might not do much TSI, timber stand improvement. They might not do much work at all on their farm. But some of the things that you can do to blend, there's a way that you can blend the forestry work to grow trees for income, for a profit, and then maintain a healthy wildlife habitat. I've already mentioned TSI, timber stand improvement, thinning. I've already mentioned thinning. When pine trees are the age of about 15 or 16 years, they are very much tight. The ground cover is going to be bare. It's going to be a layer of pine straw. There's really not much going on to it, but you can thin it about 15 or 16 years. Once you thin that pine stand, you open up the canopy, lower the basal area, which means more sunlight is getting in. That sunlight hits the dirt, and you will disturb the native seed bank. And what we've done, the pine stands, is actually thin it a second or a third time. So the more you thin it, the more open it gets. And when you incorporate prescribed fire, which I know can be, it was definitely a daunting task for us to do the first couple times, but prescribed fire, what you're able to do for anyone that's not familiar with it is with pine trees, very quickly you end up with a thick carpet of pine straw. and there's very little vegetation breaking through that carpet of pine straw. Do a prescribed fire, burn it off, and if it's done pretty clean, you'll have pure exposed dirt. With exposed canopy, sunlight gets in there, and you'll disturb that native seed bank, and you'll end up with just incredible amount, depending on when you burn, in the dormant season, you'll end up with a lot of grasses, forage, browse. In our area, it's American beautyberry, blackberry, partridge pea, for turkeys, goldenrod, pokeweed. All of that forage in plants you're seeing being covered now that's really making a big push for that holistic land management. Clear cuts. I talked a minute ago about clear cutting sites, and I know that can be daunting, but if your goal, in my opinion, should be to avoid the monoculture on your pine farm. And so what we've done after we had those two smallish clear cut sites was what I like to call is to checkerboard the property, to where you clear cut maybe 5 to maybe 50 acre blocks, anywhere from 5 to 50 acres. And you try to just checkerboard your property, have a diversity. So you have a pine thicket, and after a clear cut, depending on the soil, those pine trees, you know, in the South, we have a very, very long growing season. Our green up started at the end of February. It's been going crazy throughout March, and it goes all the way to the first frost, which is about the first week in November. So our pine trees go very, very quickly, and those clear-cut replant sites will thicken up for outstanding deer bedding and deer thickets and fawning cover and nesting cover for turkeys within about 1 to 3 years, depending on the soil. And then it'll last anywhere from 6 to 10 years, again, depending on the soil. You know, the darker, lower lying soil, the probably thicker it's going to get. And when deer bed in there, it is absolutely killer hunting. And that's some of my favorite hunting to do, especially early season in August and early September, when it's 100 degrees outside during the day. But the coolest part of the day, every day, is at night. And so if you know where the deer are feeding at night, an ag field or maybe a food plot system. A lot of times what I like to do is to climb right on the edge of that young pine thicket and a mature pine stand that's been thinned, it's been burned. So, you know, you can get 20, 30 feet up as high as you want. And with that vegetation that's been disturbed and that native seed bank that you've burned, or if you had a thin and it grows up, that vegetation can grow by the fall anywhere from 2 to 5 feet tall, and deer will feel very comfortable slipping through their browsing and making their way back to their bedding site. And so that, you know, pine farms might have a stigma as far as being like a wildlife wasteland, but if you blend these management practices, it can absolutely be a wildlife haven, in my opinion.
So with these clear cuts that you're doing, the checkerboard clear cut, am I right that you are contracting these clear cuts out to loggers to do this commercially? Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. And then, so you contract that out, they come in, they clear it out, et cetera, et cetera. They do everything you just described. Do you do the replanting, or do you have someone, or does somebody else come in and replant them? And are you replanting just as wildlife openings at that point, or are you replanting in rows for future harvest?
So we would contract the actual timber sale for the clear cut. And then we have been doing most of the chemical sprays. So after it's cut, you know, let's say we cut sometime this spring or summer, we would go in late summer, early fall and spray it and just spray the ground to kill off all the volunteer sprouts, you know, hardwoods, sweet gums, and then other volunteer pine trees, kill those off. And then we would replant, contract the work to be replanted pine trees the next dormant growing season. So January, February of next year. I do have plans for our next timber sale I'm going to clear cut a section and I'm going to let it grow up wild. Just volunteer, just let it grow up wild. That was a suggestion that Joe Hamilton had to us a couple of years ago when he first came to the farm. Was, you know, he was looking at some of the areas where it was probably taking deer a little bit longer to get to, as far as, you know, to feed. And they wouldn't get to those areas until after dark. So he just suggested clear cut it and then just let it grow wild. And so by doing that, you're not growing pine trees, you know, you're not maximizing the timber production, but we're going to let it grow up wild. And then he said to not let it see its third birthday. So after 3 years, burn it or mow it down and just start over again.
So keep setting it back and keep it in that early successional stage.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So, yeah.
So you've got the checkerboard of clear cuts that you're doing. You've got some thinning throughout the pine stands. Is there any other timber related projects that you guys have tried over the years? Have you dabbled in hinge cutting or anything, girdling, anything else like that? And how has any of that worked for you?
We do a lot of girdling and a lot of hack and squirt, probably more hack and squirt. Sweet gum trees are prevalent down here. You will fight sweet gums. I mean, we've been fighting sweet gums for a very long time. They sprout very quickly. They grow very quickly and they offer really nothing for wildlife. I have done some hinge cutting, not much. I did a number of sections last summer and I really didn't see, I haven't noticed much sign deer activity around them. But at the same time is that we have a lot of, in my opinion, better bedding sites. So, you know, I don't know if, I don't think they were choosing to use them and maybe I didn't have them in the best locations. I'm not sure. Other timber projects we do, something we've been doing for a number of years now is early successional disking, light disking with a harrow. And that's something you can do down here anytime from December to about March. And all you need is a tractor or a harrow, or maybe you can even, if you can hook up a harrow to a four-wheeler or ATV, but you lightly disk the ground surface, just barely, just enough to disturb the soil. And it's very similar to a prescribed fire. You're disturbing that native seed bank. And as long as those areas get sunlight, you'll see those same native plants grow up that I mentioned before. We've done a lot of those in the timber where there's maybe a fire break that gets some sunlight, maybe some roads, fallow fields. I mean, I would implore everyone listening just to do that. I mean, you can still do it now. Go out and lightly disk some areas that maybe you wouldn't touch with anything else and just observe what happens to it. Observe what grows up, what pops. And then pay attention to what's being eaten, what's being snipped off. That's an excellent way of creating a border around ag fields or in a food plots if you don't have the means to plant.
Yeah, you're just adding diversity and switching things up, adding those edges, and I got to believe that's almost always a win-win.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanna go back to one more thing on the timber side of things, because I'm going to make an assumption here for other people based on an experience I've had, which is that getting some of this larger scale timber work done, it seems like it seems like there's a number of hoops to go through to actually make it happen that many of us maybe don't know how to go through. For example, we've got a little family farm property up in northern Michigan, 40 acres, a lot of timber on it. And I know that we could benefit from getting some of these trees out of there and getting some openings, et cetera. We had a forester come out and take a look at things. And he said, you know, this can go. It'd be great if you could get this out. But his concern was that it was too small a scale to likely get somebody out there willing to take the time to work on a project of that size. And so in the years since, I've kind of, kind of taking a couple different stabs at trying to get people to come out, but maybe I don't know what I'm doing, or maybe I was talking to the wrong people. But I bring all that up to ask you, what has that process been like for you in contracting out work? You know, what does that all entail? If somebody's listening and they want to see what opportunities they have to manage their timber, who do you talk to? How do you get that process started? What have you learned in the years since about how to do that better, how to work with a forester or a logging or a logger, or anyone like that? You know, what does that look like? What are some of the best practices?
I would certainly suggest anyone listening to connect with a forester. And, you know, unless someone has a background in forestry work, and it's not necessarily, I mean, it's kind of like doing your taxes, you know. I mean, you could probably figure out how to do your taxes and file if you wanted to. There's ways you could figure it out and do it, but some people would rather just hire a CPA and have it done the right way. Why? It's because a CPA might be able to save you some money, maybe some tax exemptions. So, you know, going with a professional, there very well could be some benefits to it. So I would definitely say connect with a forester. And on top of that, they're going to have connections to the timber buyers. They're going to have connections to the local mills where, you know, where the timber's going, you know. So there are some benefits there. But you also definitely want to connect with a forester. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, you obviously are into hunting. So you want to find a forester that can blend and has a wildlife background of some sort, and that gets what your goals are. So you don't necessarily need to, you know, get a forester to do whatever he or she wants to do. Connect with them, set your goals, tell them what you want to do, and prioritize things. If it's maximizing tree production, then you know, that's what it needs to be. If you're trying to blend tree production in wildlife habitat, there's things you can do. Right now, it can be challenging to get a timber contract signed and then get the crew on site. There are so much. I was reading something the other day. I mean, there are decades of trees on the stump, a decade's worth of supply of trees on the stump that are ready to be cut. There's actually an article in the Wall Street Journal about this, I think maybe last year in 2020, about the amount of people, mostly in the Southeast, that were planting pine trees back in the 80s and the early 90s as a nest egg, as their retirement. And a lot of those are coming up for harvest. And we had a lot of mills and a lot of timber mills in our area of the state and Georgia that closed down during the recession, during the Great Recession. 2009 to 2012 area range. So when those mills closed, we're left with fewer places for our timber to go. And so there's basically a lot of supply inventory on the stump right now. So I say this because if you have a smaller property, or even like our property, we're not looking to clear cut large sections. We're looking to clear cut smaller sections, which that might not be. If you want to clear cut 50 acres, that might not be attractive for a timber buyer. But if you can lump in maybe a thin, maybe you do a third thinning on a pine stand, and then you tie in a clear cut site, that might be attractive for them. Or I recently had a conversation about the power of co-ops, the power of wildlife co-ops. And you know, we all know the value of that, talking with your neighbor as far as deer management, what they're seeing and what you're shooting. But another benefit of that is timber work. You're not going to lump everything together on one contract, but you can absolutely pull your properties together and, you know, approach, you know, have your forester or approach a timber buyer with it and saying, you know, we got properties A, B, and C that we like to lump all together. And that's much, much more attractive for the timber crew to be able to move into one general area and to post up and to cut, because it costs them so much money to move the machines around and the equipment from property to property.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So let's say we've tried thinning, we've done clear cutting, we've done a number of these different timber things as you've done. it sounds like one of the next steps you had was adding prescribed fire to the mix, burning out that understory underneath those thinned, you know, pine stands. What have you learned over the years about that? What's worked best when it comes to fire? What are you really achieving with that too?
With fire, I think what works best, what's worked for us is to carve the property up into sections. We carve it up, each track in about three sections, and we burn one section every year. And so each section is being burned once every 3 years. There's no plan, one management plan that's going to fit, you know, every property. You need to, just like everything else, after you burn, observe what happens, observe what grows, what comes up, and what the deer are actually eating. We found that burning a section once every 3 years is adequate to produce just killer forage, and then also it'll still leave places thick briar patches for bedding. And so even my burning and some of these thick, you know, brambles and briars, those are excellent bedding sites. And then when you combine that with the pine thickets, we've got plenty of bedding. You know, me personally, if I had to make a decision, if for some reason I had to make a decision on whether or not I could plant the best food plot seed every year or to burn every year, and I could only choose one option, I would burn every year as opposed to planting food plots. I still like food plots, but as far as the bang for the buck, there's no question what you get in the diversity that you get from prescribed fire. So a lot of the bucks I've killed, I mean, the majority of them is going to be in pine stands that have been burnt, and I'm climbing right on the edge of that pine thicket. And so they're either going back to bed or they're coming out of bed, and they hit that next block of a thin pine stand that has, like I said, 2 to 5 feet tall vegetation and browse, and they're going to mill through there. And they're going to mill their way back at first light to go bed, or they're going to step out and kind of mill through there and take their time and feed and browse and make sign and whatnot until they get to that destination food plot that's an acre or two wide that they really don't want to step out until dark because they know what's there.
Am I right that you need to get the timing right on when you would do a burn like that to achieve that kind of natural food plot transition zone in a stand of pines like that? Like when are you doing that burn? How are you doing that burn to achieve that 2 to 5 feet of kind of attractive growth while still in the pines?
You're looking at anywhere in the dormant season, starting in January to about March is when most people do it. We usually run into a situation where a lot of our land is very wet in January and sometimes February. It's just cold, it's wet, it's a little too wet to burn. But, you know, I had a conversation with Dr. Marcus Lashley with the University of Florida. He's like the go-to prescribed fire biologist. You know, I had a long conversation with him, and you know, burning this time of year, January through March, you're going to get a lot of grasses. But that foliage, that forage is going to, deer like that young, tender, succulent sprouts. Like when they eat briars or when they eat the, you know, devil's walking stick, which I don't know if y'all have that up in Michigan or not, but it's, it's very thick. I mean, they're not eating it when it's mature. They're eating the young sprouts, you know, of the briars and everything else, poison ivy. And so if you burn, let's say in February, a lot of that is going to be a little too, they're not going to hit it in the summer. So what Dr. Lashley was saying was that you should really burn, if you want that excellent, forage throughout the summer, which for us is the stress period. You know, you might be around snow right now. I was talking to someone in New York.
Snowing today.
That's just crazy. I mean, I was talking to a guy in New York State on Friday, and he's dealing with snow. I mean, we had snow stick January of 18 And then we had Snow Stick, I think, like 2011 and then 1988. So, so like our stressful period is not the winter. Now, it certainly is, but our stressful period for whitetails is the summer. You know, it's 90 to 100 degrees. Of course, a little bit cool in the shade, but there's extreme heat. There could be a drought. There's a high level of insects, bugs. And then you get with the heat, you get the stress and the demands of the antler production, which there's so much stress on the body for the bucks to grow those antlers every single year. And then you have the lactation, you know, the final stages of the doe, the mother doe's gestation period. And then she's got to produce that quality milk. So but Dr. Lashley was saying to meet those summer demands, you really ought to burn late spring. And, you know, late spring, and then you have that fresh, tender, succulent sprouts from all these plants growing back throughout the summer and late summer, early fall to meet those demands. If you were to burn, late summer, early fall, you would get a lot more hardwoods, a lot more forbs to grow, if I had that right. We have never done a late summer, early fall, or early fall burn. I would like to, just to be able to have an experiment to see what happens. Yeah. But for us, it's just timing. It's extremely hot, and that's another animal in itself to burn that time of year. And we're also usually gearing up for deer season at that point. But to answer your questions, you do produce different results on burning in the dormant season or the growing season.
You bring up an interesting point, which is, you know, how your main stress period that you're trying to prepare for is the summer compared to maybe up here where it's late winter, right? I'm curious, you must hear from a lot of people, whether you're listening to podcasts or reading articles or books or anything like that, about land management, habitat improvement, that's coming from a northerner's perspective or the Midwest. I got to believe a lot of things like what you just mentioned simply are different than what you're dealing with down there in the Southeast. Is there anything else that really stands out to you as something that you're dealing with or that you have to do differently that's dramatically counter to the conventional wisdom coming out of the Midwest or some of these other places from a habitat management perspective?
A little bit. I could probably rattle off a couple dozen ways how we're different than like Iowa, for instance.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, once some top level points would be one, I've already mentioned it, but our growing season is much, much longer. And a lot of times in the Southeast, if you look at an aerial map, it's just going to be one massive green block. You're not necessarily going to see distinctive land features. You're not going to say, oh, well, that's a funnel. That's a pinch point. That's probably where they're bedding. That's where they're feeding. It's very, very, you really need boots on the ground to be able to look to see, because you'll see green pine trees, but you don't know, you might not know really what it looks like. Are they bedding in there? Is it just too open? So it can be a little challenging to figure out how the deer are using your property in the South, because they can bed everywhere. Bedding is something that is significantly different. When people talk about, you know, finding buck beds and hunting buck beds, that's not really, in my opinion, something in the Southeast, unless you've got a very unique property. When I talk about deer bedding, I'm really referring to deer bedding and to where it's, you know, does, bucks, you know, and there are some areas where bucks tend to bed, but it's usually like a general area, like a young thicket, might be 5 or 50 acres where they're bedding somewhere in there, or it could be in a swamp. We have, you know, some swamp systems where they bed, but it can be, because it's just so thick in most places. When you burn, I'd mentioned this before, you'll generate a lot of thickets that deer eat, but they also bed in them. So when you're laying out your property and looking at the design as far as access, where do you want your stand? Where do you want to hunt? You know, of course, we have the permanent stands, but I traditionally hunt mobily. And that was another turning point for me when I started to do that more. But when I'm hunting myself, or if I'm putting out a guest or trying to figure out where they're going to hunt, I look at more so of like, where is their scent going? How are they walking in? Like, where are they parking? How are they getting to their spot? How are they walking in and where their scent is blowing? Because with the Southeast being so dense and being a very high deer density, and that's something else, another difference than like the Midwest, we typically have a higher deer density. So there's deer everywhere and they're bedding everywhere. So when you go to hunt, you're going to educate deer. You're going to spook deer. You're going to educate deer that you didn't even know was there. But that's another major factor as far as thinking about your access. And it's not so much, you know, hunting pressure, like pulling the trigger, but just simply going into the woods and walking. I think more about like leaving at dark. When you're walking in an hour before sunrise at dark, or you're leaving at dark, there's deer all around you. You might not see them or hear them, but they're watching you and paying attention to you. So it's just a lot to, it's a lot to, you know, try to put together.
Oh yeah. Does that factor in to any of your land projects at all? Just that challenge of, you know, deer in much of the Southeast being able to live anywhere, being able to bed anywhere. Do you ever try to strategically plan where you want some of these cuts or where you don't want some of these cuts to allow for any kind of safe place for you to access or exit or anything like that? Or is it just a lost cause?
No, it's not. That's a excellent point you made. And I can give you a real example that we're doing right now. We got a track that the last owner was a timber company. And before they sold it, they cut the majority of the pine trees, most of them at least. And they cut it years before they sold it, and it was just left to grow up wild, those clear cut sections. So it was pretty thick sections growing up. I mean, just a mix of volunteer pine trees and hardwoods and everything else. But we were left in kind of a transition time where it was, if you let an area grow up in the Southeast wild, you're going to get a lot of hardwoods. It's going to be mixed, but you either have to just let it roll for a lot longer periods for that growth to become timber, to become merchantable commercial timber that someone would want to buy for pulpwood or saw timber, or pole saw, and that's going to take a lot longer. Or do you just bite the bullet and clear cut it? But we were at a stage where it wasn't worth anything. I mean, we were trying to get a fuel chipper in there to, you know, mulch the material for fuel chips, which there is a market for that, but there's just not many fuel chip crews out there. And we end up just having to get a crew just to simply mulch it down very rough. Basically push it over, mulch down the stumps. I mean, these are trees that weren't even considered pulpwood. And then we've already gone in those areas to replant. We've already planted pine trees, and we were sitting on that project for many years, so we just didn't know how to tackle it. But what I'm looking forward to doing is that's very close, pretty much very flush to a creek swamp that I like to hunt. And if anyone follows some of my content, like on Instagram, I post a lot of, I've got some trail cameras down the swamp, and I keep it on video mode, mm-hmm. which I can
get some great videos.
Well, thank you. And so that's, there's a number of bucks that bed down that swamp every single year. I mean, I'll get a number of mature bucks down there, but it's been to say the least. I mean, you could also look at my Instagram feed and tell it's a challenge to kill them. It's a challenge to harvest them because they're in the swamp that has it's fairly, you know, narrowish. It's not, you know, it's not incredibly wide, but there's a 15 to 20 foot drop off on both sides that you know drop down to it. So the thermals are crazy to hunt in the swamp. And then you have the fact that it is a flowing creek. So you do have the wind currents through there. Long story short, it's extremely hard. It's been hard for me, maybe not hard for you to come, but you could probably roll one and kill them all. But
I don't think so.
But in what I'm describing that area is like if you were to see a deer to harvest, it's going to either be on a road or a fire break that we've created or a food plot, because most of the timber wasn't old enough to really open up and thin and to be able to climb over it and be able to burn over it. Some of it was, some of it wasn't. So by clear cutting that section, we have now opened it up, and it's going to be, I think, very, very good for the next couple of years to hunt those edges. Deer love edges. We're going to get a lot more sunlight, a lot native, you know, vegetation growing. And then in a couple of years, it's going to be good to hunt over a clear cut. Especially the first couple of years when it's not quite warm season bedding. It's not quite tall enough and shaded enough for deer to bed in when it's hot, but it'll be good cold season bedding for them to go out and bed during the cold weather and be in the sun.
Man, there's a lot of different factors at play, aren't there? keep you busy for a very long time.
Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
Something I really like about this, we've talked for an hour, and we have almost not touched on food plots one time, which is kind of rare in a land management conversation. Yeah. So many people want to jump to food plots, and like that's just like the sexy kind of topic in the land world. That's seemingly the one that delivers the most results right out the gate. Some people assume it's the easiest, but many times it's not. Nonetheless, food plots are a part of what you guys do though too, right? What does your food plot kind of practice look like on this property now? I know you mentioned in the beginning you had some struggles with not having enough open space. You mentioned how they're opening up those logging pads. You're expanding those little kind of hidey hole food plots. But now, you know, almost 20 years later, how do food plots fit into this overarching strategy you guys have now to work in the land?
What we've done for a number of years now was that we have maintained some of the smaller food plots, maybe a quarter or like a half acre. And those are more of kill sites, you know, where it's not, I say kill sites, it might sound barbaric, but it the idea behind that term, in my opinion, is, or from my understanding, I should say, is that it's not enough acres to, you're not feeding the deer as far as nutrition. They're not really getting much out of the nutrition side. You're just attracting them in to be able to, you know, harvest them. We still maintain those, but we've increased the size of our main food plots. There's a nice, it had always been used by the farmer, kind of center of our property. There was a series of ag fields that the farmer has been slowly turning those over to us. It's very dark soil, which is great, but it stays wet when he's going in and to plant this time. I mean, they're going to start planting pretty soon. So a lot of times those fields are a little too wet when they go to plant. And then some of the other food plots, we've expanded the size. So by expanding the size, we have met the demand of our deer density. Because if you plant, if you're in a relatively high deer density, which might be over, if it's over, I think like the normal average is maybe 20 to 40 deer per square mile. If you're over 50, 60, 75, going towards 100 per square mile, and you plant food plots, you need some size to it, because if not, the deer are just going to wipe it out very, very, very quickly, depending on what you plant. So a lot of our food plots, we have expanded the size, and we're going to try a mix this year, a warm season mix, to see if we have some better results. We've had some problems for a while of keeping the deer out of soybeans so that they can become browse tolerant. You know, some of the forage beans that you can buy nowadays that grow very viney mm-hmm. and grow very tall, they need to get about knee high or maybe about thigh high to become somewhat browse tolerant, which means the deer can sniff them off and they'll grow back. But if they go in there and hammer them when they're sprouting, you know, under a foot, they won't kill the plant probably, but it's going to be stunted. And it's going to grow wider, but it's not going to really grow tall, and it's not going to fill out. So we use some various management practices to really keep the deer at bay for a couple of weeks before those, you know, whether it's sun hemp or soybeans, to grow and to become browse tolerant. But over the course of maybe about 5 years, the deer have really, you know, just like everything else, you can educate deer, and they realize those tactics of roping off the food plot or using malorganite fertilizer, or using even human scent. I mean, we would take dryer sheets and put them around the rope of the fire, around the rope on the food plots, just to try to keep them at bay, and then to take it down once the food plot was established. So in what I see every year is that if our farmer on our property, or the surrounding farmers, if they plant cotton, for instance, the deer are going to hammer our warm season food plots much more than if they planted peanuts, soybeans, or corn, because those will be established first before our food plots probably, and they'll feed on those, and that'll help deter some of the pressure on our food plots. But food plots are, in my opinion, and absolutely, it's a key if you can do it. For diversity, it's all about diversity. I mean, I know I talked about a while ago about if I had to make a choice between prescribed fire or planting food plots, I would do prescribed fire. However, food plots give you that diversity, and food plots allow me to be able to have success in those burn sites, because they're going to those food plots. And that's why, like, I'll sit on food plots early season, you know, when they're fresh and deer aren't used to hunters yet, or I'll sit them on very, very late season. But the way I hunt food plots during the meat of the season is really nowhere near them. I'll use a destination food plot, or maybe that food plot system hub that we have on our property, which if anyone is looking at, if they can design their property, or they're maybe looking at doing a clear cut site, maybe clear cutting on the somewhat centered on your property, and then converting that site to you know, food plots, stump it, convert it to food plots. You have a hub on your property that's centered. And sure, you can hunt on it, you know, in the evenings, but I exploit those food plots as destinations by, you know, you got to think about how many deer are using those food plots or ag fields at night. There's probably the majority of deer in that area or within that food plot area throughout the night. You know, deer, whitetails are very social animals, whether they're feeding or just making sign, whatever they're doing, they're very social. So a lot of my morning hunts will be planned of, you know, being outside of a pine thicket or a thicket, knowing that they bed in there and that they're going to that destination food plot. It could be a couple thousand yards or maybe a quarter mile away, but I'll cut them off going to or from that food plot. So that's how, you know, I use the food plots a lot. Hunt is really just, I don't sit on them, but I, you know, catch them, hunt them going to and from.
Yeah. You mentioned sun hemp, and that's something I have zero experience with, but I've seen it kind of popping up more and more over recent years, especially down south. Can you fill me in on how you're using sun hemp? What your experience has been with that so far?
Yeah. So sun hemp is a fairly new on the food plot deer management scene. I think it first came on the scene as far as, cattle, like cows. It's originally from India. It's a legume. And you have to, it thrives in the South because you have to, you really need to be, I think, in a much lower, it's a subtropical legume. And it's, I think either Dr. Craig Harper or maybe the NDA did a study on it. It's about 30% crude protein, which is getting up there with soybeans. It can grow anywhere from 4 to 8 feet tall and grow very thick. I mean, it can grow about an inch a day. It grows very quickly. It's excellent for cover crop. If you want, that's how a lot of farmers were originally using it, as a cover crop. It doesn't drain on your soil like corn, for instance. We don't plant much corn. Corn is very demanding on your soil. It strips of nutrients. Sun hemp is actually a soil builder. It's loaded with nitrogen. You just, you know, mow it down after it's dead in the season, let it decompose back to the soil. Deer love the young leaves on the plants. It's tender, and they'll eat the main stem too. At a certain point, after it gets a little tall, maybe 5-6 feet tall, the stems do become a little fibrous, and they won't eat it. But they'll eat the new leaves. And the best parts about it is that you can cut it, you can bush hog it, you can hit it with a bush hook, and it'll grow back, it'll sprout back. As long as you're still in that growing season. So for us, it's all the way to the 1st of November. So I like to plant a whole field of it and then just mow some shooting lanes or use it for, a border around your food plot, especially if you have somewhat of a low growing plant in your food plot, plant that around your border. It's very thick, very dense, it's loaded with protein.
Yeah, I love having those screening elements to just provide that extra safety around a feeding area like that. That's just so useful. Mark, I want to pivot a little bit. I heard about timber, fire, food. I want to talk a little bit about the future of this place, because I think a lot of times when it comes to land management and owning land or working land, I think the idea of legacy starts to creep in, I think, for a lot of us. And when you look at the future of this place that you've put so much time into, so much energy, so many of your hopes and dreams, what do you envision for the future? What do you hope for the future? What do you think that looks like?
What I hope for the future is that we can, and this is something that we're working on now, is developing a forestry management plan to be able to maintain the farm for the next generation. And, you know, that's something that my father has talked about many times to me. He's a retired CPA, and he saw a lot in his career. He had a lot of clients that own land, own farms or timber tracts like this, or hunting ground. And he always told me that a lot of times land or real estate just does not survive the grandkids. You know, it'll transfer down to the kids and they'll get along. But when it gets down to the grandkids, a lot of times at that point, you'll have some differences of opinions or uses, or everyone's not really using the property, and it's hard for the farm to stay, you know, without people wanting to sell it. So the plan, this is something that we've been working on. I've been trying to take over more with forestry work, is to have a true forest management plan. And this kind of ties right back into, you know, diversifying your land and constantly be cutting and you know, so you avoid that monoculture. But, you know, if someone has merchantable timber on their property, they should really, again, connect with a forester or someone in the know to be able to come up with a standing inventory value of your merchantable timber, whether it's pine trees or hardwoods. Well, you know, if there's a plan to sell it one day, you should have a rough estimate about the current value of your inventory, of your timber crop, and then project out what you should be getting for it when you go to sell, you know, 5 years down the road, 10 years, and then sort of map out, you know, 5 years from now, what are we going to clear cut? What are we going to thin? How much should we be selling at that point? And then you start to kind of develop a plan to where you're projecting out the future income to be able to cover the cost of owning and operating the farm. And that's something we are working on now to try to maintain that, keep the farm in the family, and then also do everything we can to be better land stewards, to be better conservationists. Because, I mean, everything what we're talking about today, Mark, is about, you know, being a good land steward and being a good conservationist. I mean, you know, a lot of what we do is to kill big giant bucks, but there's more to it than that. I mean, I'm one of the projects I'm doing now is kind of, you know, ongoing long game projects will be to continue to work on our bobwhite quail. We do have several coveys, wild coveys on our property, and then also the eastern wild turkey. I mean, as far as legacy, I would love to be able to build the property up with a healthy turkey population, because right now, I mean, it's you know, it's not headline news right now, but the eastern wild turkey, the population has been dwindling for well over a decade, and it's not something that's going to get better overnight. The change is going to come from landowners, at least in the southeast. And that's, you know, it's not the work's not being done on public land, but when I say that, it's just because most of the southeast is private land. And so, you know, if that's something with a legacy, I would love to change.
Yeah. Now, speaking of private land legacy opportunities, another thing that I understand you guys have done is place a significant portion of the property into a conservation easement. Is that right? Did you guys do that? And can you describe to me, you know, or for others maybe that aren't familiar, what that means and why you guys decided to do that?
Yeah, so a conservation easement is something that if anyone's interested, I would definitely suggest you talk with your accountant, your CPA, or maybe attorney about it. But it basically, you're putting a section of property, your whole property or a section of it, into a conservation easement to where no one, you, the current owner, or any, you know, owners down the road can develop it. They can't carve off a home site by the highway and sell it, or they can't put multiple houses. There are some different things that you can put on the property, you know, like a skinning shed or a tractor shed, stuff like that, but it's protecting it from being developed. And there are tax benefits from it. You do get a very nice tax break from it. So a lot of people are doing that. We're actually looking at something that had relatively recently has been on my radar as far as carbon credits. You know, wetland credits have been, you know, wetland mitigation credits have been something for a long time now, but carbon credits are at least somewhat new to me, and we will be diving in that pretty soon. And that's tied into not cutting trees. So I can't really speak on that, but that's something that we are going to look into.
So the idea with that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that would be basically getting financial incentives to keep trees on the ground, and people essentially incentivize you, pay you to do that, as a way to offset carbon that they're using in some other way. And you're keeping carbon in there by not cutting the trees in certain places. That's the idea with carbon credits, right?
At a high level. That's correct.
Yeah.
That's my understanding. And it makes sense, but at the same time, as you know, there's certain stands where we're not going to cut. I mean, we know when we're not going to cut them. We're not going to cut them before 10 years, let's say, or 5 years. But that's just something we got to dive into. But yeah,
it's interesting. Yeah. Now back to the conservation easement. Why did you guys, I mean, I can make assumptions, but why did you guys decide that was something you wanted to do? Because I know that's no small decision, saying that, you know, okay, we are not going to develop this. We're not going to, you know, parcel it off. This is going to be protected in perpetuity as a somewhat intact piece of undeveloped habitat from here on out. What was that decision-making process like for you and the family?
It was mostly my father at the time, but he wanted to protect the farm. My father spent a lot of time, especially after he retired, and he's put a lot of heart and soul in the property. And so I think for him, it was probably to secure it for the next generation and, you know, to try to, you know, secure our legacy on the land so that we're not, you know, it doesn't, you know, end up becoming, you know, something else being developed. I mean, it's just protecting everything that we're putting into it for the next property owner. I mean, that's something that can be a little different to think about, you know, I know what it's like when you lease land and you're putting management or you're doing some work into a lease land, if you're a hunting club, because you don't know, you know, if you're leasing land, it's probably, whether it's written or verbal, probably a 12-month deal. So you don't know what you're doing. I mean, you're passing up on bucks, letting bucks walk, shooting does, maybe doing some habitat type work on a low level, but you don't know if things are going to change for the next calendar year. But for private land, it's just something to, I think, protect and just to secure that everything we're doing will remain in the land for the next owner.
Yeah. So you've got a couple of young kids yourself. What's all this, how's that changed things for you, if at all, when you look at the work you're doing, when you look at the future of this place, how has kids factored into how you approach land management and any of this kind of stuff now?
A lot, tremendously. I mean, it's funny, you know, thinking back about, you know, years ago, listening to your podcast, when y'all were expecting and before you had kids and after kids,
yeah.
It's, you know, very similar. I mean, you know, I'd mentioned before, but about some hunters picking and choosing when they hunt. I mean, you know, even when I was married before kids, unless we had some kind of social engagement, I could hunt when I wanted to. So now it's, you know, picking and choosing the best times to, you know, between work and family, to go up there, year round to hunt or do habitat work. The hunting aspect, you know, I have brought my kids a couple times to hunt, but not with, you know, a firearm. I haven't shot a firearm around them. They're 2 and 5, so not quite old enough, I think, to be around them yet. Pretty soon. We've sat in the stand a couple times just without a gun or a bow. But this time of year is a good time to bring the kids. I've been bringing both of them for a couple of years now to shed hunt, look for antlers. And that's the prime time when I do most of my scouting is looking for sheds before that green up, because you can really see, so much more of the land, how deer are using it. But yeah, some of the habitat work, I'm able to bring the kids up and do some of the stuff with. So it's caused me to do a lot of work from home as far as planning, you know, planning out, and maybe, you know, delegating some of the work to other people that can do it, whether it's my father that's now retired or one of my brothers to be able to do it. But to answer your question very quickly, would probably be, it's caused me to be more focused on time management, because you know this working the back 40, that you spend half the time when you go to your farm fixing stuff, looking for stuff.
Yes.
You go there and, you know, between the farmhouse and the tractor shed, you know, things get moved around. Things don't get put back where they were. You're looking for things. Things break. I mean, we went up in February to do a controlled burn, and we had the weather conditions. We had the burn permit, everything aligned, and then our tractor broke down. And we spent the better part of the day fixing it. It was some kind of wire that shorted underneath, but we couldn't burn. And that was a heartbreaker because it was a bust for the day. In that time of year, that really couldn't, with the tractor down, we couldn't do much else. But if we were to burn without a tractor with a harrow in the back, if that fire got loose or crossed the cut fire break, there could be some problems. So it's just, and that goes back to what I said earlier, is just to take things slow. We didn't know what we were doing in the beginning. So we had to take things slow. I mean, I think I told you we did take things slow, but we had to, because we didn't know what we were doing. You know, it was a big learning curve. And so, there's nothing wrong with taking things slow, you know, breathe, let the property develop on its own. And then over that time period, you'll learn how deer use the landscape, how they use it, what kind of deer density you have, and then you'll be able to manipulate the land based on what the wildlife needs.
Yeah. If you had a little piece of paper, like the little piece of paper that you find inside of a fortune cookie, and if you could write something on that little piece of paper, stuff it into a fortune cookie, and give it to yourself back in 2006, when you and the family were going to begin this land management project, what message do you wish you could have written on that little piece of paper to read back then?
That's a good question, Mark.
It could be a longer piece of paper if you want.
I would probably, one thing would just be, don't sweat the small stuff. There's going to be a lot of failures, whether it's you're trying to work the land or hunting failures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, wildlife is a renewable resource. And I'm not saying that lightly for whitetails and turkey and quail, everything else, but it's a renewable resource, and just take your time with it. And just don't sweat the small stuff, because there's going to be a lot of failures, but that's how you learn. That's how you get to become a better hunter. And then I've thought about this second point many times, is I look back on some land features like pine thickets, that we had some new thickets that were planted pine trees that were good, tight, you know, thick, nasty bedding sites that I did not exploit. I did not hunt. I was focused on other spots, and just to not let those, I mean, hunt those areas and don't just let those grow up. And cause you know, some of those pine thickets, you have a window to hunt them. And at a certain point deer stop bedding in them. If I could do things over again, I would probably say to get off and hunt mobily a lot. I should have done that a lot quicker. A lot quicker.
Better late than never.
That was a turning point for me as a hunter. I think probably I can look back on, pinpoint that at 2015.
Yeah.
When that changed.
Yeah, I've certainly had similar experiences too. Well, Mark, I really enjoyed this. It's always a kick for me just to get to hear about these different places and different ways people are doing this and having fun and learning about the land and figuring out how to hunt and improve their spots. And your story down there in South Carolina is a perfect example of that. So where can people go if they want to learn more about what you're doing? I know you've got a website and some different things. Is there anything that you'd point folks to if they want to follow along more with what you're up to?
Yes. They can follow me. They can find me on Instagram. It's at Mark Haslam. My Instagram has really, it's been It's pretty much just been, I've been showcasing what I've been doing, the farm and hunting stuff, habitat work, for a number of years now. And because I was, about a year ago, beginning of last year, 21, I've been sitting on the idea for a while, but I finally launched a website, southeastwhitetail.com, just to showcase what I'm doing at the farm. And I think I want to highlight some of the stuff in the Southeast, because I think just so much of the hunting content out there is driven a lot towards the Midwest, and some of that stuff, you know, we can definitely use down here, but a lot of it we can't. And a lot of it is just, we've got a different terrain and different deer herds. And so I wanted to really showcase, you know, what I'm doing. And so that's where people can find me.
Awesome. Well, I would definitely recommend people check that out. And Mark, thank you for your time. It was fun.
Well, thanks for having me on, Mark. I appreciate it. Thanks for talking with me.
Let's do it again soon.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. And that is it. Thanks all for tuning in. I appreciate it. It's been a fun chat. I've been just taking a little bit of time peering back behind the house, watching turkeys strutting around. So it's spring. It's a great time of year to be out there working the land, working food plots, hanging stands, or like I mentioned, turkey hunting. So hope you're out there and having a good time. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, stay wired to hunt.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.